Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Well, we are at episode 3 Cubed. What's the headline?
Missing misery.
Missing misery. Whose misery?
Ours, the American people, in the grip of inflation. Here is President Biden addressing that question in a 60-minute interview from September 2022.
Well, first of all, let's put this in perspective. Inflation rate month to month was just an inch, hardly at all.
You're not arguing that 8.3 is good news.
No, I'm not saying it is good news, but it was 8.2 or 8.2 before. I mean, it's not. I can make it sound like all of a sudden, my God, it went to 8.2%.
It's the highest inflation rate, Mr. President, in 40 years.
I got that. But guess what we are? We're in a position where for the last several months, it hasn't spiked. It has just barely, it's been basically even. And in the meantime, we created all these jobs and prices have gone up, but they've come down for energy.
Jack. The president sounds quite defensive there. And by the way, that was Scott Pelley, right, of 60 Minutes.
Yes, and he had a lot to defend. Gasoline prices had spiked 49% in a year. Rents were way up. Food was way up. Of course, gasoline and food isn't included in the inflation rate. But, you know, here's the thing. If the president had used a measure of inflation that was standard up until 1983. If he had used what used to measure inflation, the real rate of inflation wouldn't have been the highest in 40 years. It would have been the highest in over a century and the second highest in American history. The real rate of inflation was 18%. You know, you're almost getting into Argentinian territory there. Why? What was this missing measure of inflation? Well, the cost of money is not factored into the cost of living. Strangely enough, people point to the misery index and they say, you know, the misery index is great. Low inflation coming down, unemployment, employment high. But the misery index is not really capturing consumers' misery because consumers are facing a higher cost of money.
Obviously, the difference between 8 and 18% is massive. And you keep saying that 18% is the real experienced inflation in people's lives. But why was that the previous measure of inflation? I think you said it was we stopped using it in 1983. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Why did that happen? Do you know?
For recondite reasons that I wouldn't even begin to explain. But those who want to find out can read the paper that I'm following here called The Cost of Money is Part of the Cost of Living, a new research from the National Bureau of Economic Research by a team of Harvard economists led by the redoubtable Larry Summers. And they point to things like this. Home prices have risen almost 50% since the pandemic. The 30-year mortgage rate has tripled. Interest payments on 30-year mortgages have gone up 3 times since 2021. Car loan interest payments are up 80%. Credit cards went from 15 to 22%. People were paying a lot more for money, for the cost of borrowing, and which is really an essential part of living for everybody, than they had paid in in anybody's lifetime. And of course, this was reflected in consumer sentiment, which found that people thought that the worst time to buy a house in apparently 40 years was in December of just last year. People said it was the worst measure ever. Similarly with the car sales, people said, "Oh my God, we can't buy a new car with these interest rates." And so, but this is left out of the official rate of inflation. So you say, well, it's not so bad. It's just 8%. But people are experiencing something else. And when you can look at how people live in America, something like a third of Americans, you know, use their credit cards just to kind of get through their ordinary purchases. And with interest rates, you know, going up 8% just in a year, that was just money out of their other consumption, and it was a loss to the economy, and it was a blow to their confidence that tomorrow was going to be better than today. And these economists in this paper I'm quoting really bring out the missing explanation. Why the gap between good economic news, unemployment, employment up, and inflation down, stock market, and sour consumer sentiment. And the reason is the official version of reality doesn't match reality. And the consumer is feeling reality.
Okay, and so here's one of the reasons why. This is very, very important, Jack, and I'm so glad you raised it today. I just looked this up because I'm always curious why major policy change happens. So this is from a New York Times article, actually, from 2022. And regarding that inflation measure change that happened in 1983, and this relates directly to your observation that it just no longer measures people's real lives and their experience of inflation. So here's what they say. 1983 was the year where how home costs are measured in the CPI, in the Consumer Price Index, changed. In 1983, the government switched from using home prices, which used to include mortgage payments and maintenance costs. They switched away from using that in the CPI to using rental prices instead. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so the idea was that that homes, if you hold on to them, they accumulate value over time, and you're going to maybe sell it and recoup your not only the cost of your mortgage, but possibly some more money as well. But also the housing market is quite volatile, so they wanted to reduce volatility in the CPI. So they crafted this owner's equivalent rent factor, which is so, so interesting to me, right? They essentially went from real data to a manufactured data point.
Yes,
right? I mean, the manufactured data point might have some, you know, connection to values in the economy, but it wasn't measuring what people were really experiencing anymore. So I just wanted to point that out because it's a huge difference. And on top of that, since 1983, this misery that you're talking about and the unrealistic way in which economists or the federal government, you know, measures inflation, you know, we've had skyrocketing healthcare prices since then, right? We've had this radical change in retirement funding. These are two huge things now. The risk has been put almost entirely on individuals. They've got to save money if they can for those things as well. Kids who want to go to college, those costs. I mean, every single thing that used to have some sort of, in my view, government backstop is all gone now. So even people who could maybe stomach the inflation we're experiencing right now, they too still feel precarious. And I think that's what they're responding to when they're asked, how do you feel about the economy?
Oh, yes, yes. And the economists refer to that as referred pain. You know, they're not really so much worried about the economic matters as just a kind of general anxiety about the future, about politics and so on. It's referred pain. They're sort of taking it out on the economy, but not really. Mm-hmm. They're reflecting their economic experience, which is not reflected in the inflation, in the official inflation rate. And, in 1983, essentially they defined a problem out of existence. It just sort of disappeared. It's almost Talmudic. They got into this thing of, you know, housing as investment and housing as shelter. And how do you figure out the one or the other? I mean, as I say, I'm glad you explained it. I couldn't. But that's the kind of thing we live with, the sort of bad measurement of something so vital. The malady of the quotidian, as somebody said. The malady of the quotidian is, by God, I can't buy a car with these interest rates. I can't finance a new home with, what I have to do. I can't deal with my credit card bill. In short, all those things didn't get into the measure. And the result is that we've been living in a kind of fool's paradise,
yes,
where bad as it is, it was really worse,
mm-hmm,
and it remains worse. It's coming down some. According to the official rate, inflation was about 4% in December. Real rate was twice that. And now it's 3-something. Real rate may be closer to 6. But as interest rates are anticipated to come down, so the consumer is feeling a little bit more positive. The interest rates have yet to come down, but the Fed has signaled we're not going to put them up anymore. We're going on the down. So some of that is creeping through to consumers. Now, is it going to help Mr. Biden?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, but Jack, I mean, you're pinpointing a core problem of how policy is made, economic policy is made in this country, regardless of who is in the presidency, right? I mean, if you're making policy decisions or proposals based on, an inflation metric which isn't really pegged meaningfully enough to the reality that most Americans are experiencing, are you making the right policy, right? And yet,
yes,
nevertheless, we're in this situation where you were just pointing this to me yesterday, that when it comes to the age-old polling question of who handles the economy better, I think you said Donald Trump is out-polling Joe Biden by some 20%?
That's right. That's right.
And so does this kind of help explain why there's this persistent gap between how Americans see Republicans as stewards of the economy versus Democrats?
Yes, and I think it also reflects just how bad the experience of inflation has been for Americans. And they blame it on Biden. It wasn't Biden's fault. It was, a worldwide phenomenon. But did he ever explain it? Did we ever cite inflation in other countries? No. Why? Well, because it looks like he's making an excuse. Explaining reality isn't making an excuse. And, alternatives were available to Biden. He could have been bashing the Fed for raising interest rates, as Elizabeth Warren was, and so on. Of course, that's just demagoguery, because if the inflation would have remained worse if the Fed hadn't raised rates. But he could have bashed the Fed. He can bash the Fed now. Certainly Donald Trump would have, to try to put the onus on someone else. But this question of why Republicans get a better, more credit on the economy, this is a chronic issue.
Mm.
And if you look at the record, there just is no comparison between economic performance under Democratic presidents and Republican. The Democrats, more jobs, maybe slightly higher inflation, but no job, more jobs, more stock market, better, and so on. In other words, better economic performance, but the public thinks, well, the Republicans are all about money, and Trump is a businessman.
Yeah.
Of course, he's been a businessman who is a chronic bankrupt. He doesn't understand the first thing about the economy, it would seem.
Yeah.
But that is a chronic problem for the Democrats. And they don't brag about their whole economic story. The book at Brookings Institute is just out with a paper pointing out that Biden's tax cuts have exceeded his tax increases. He increased taxes on very rich people and corporations, but he's cut a range of taxes that outweigh the tax increases. Have we heard that from Biden? I'm the one who's cut taxes. No, they don't tell their story.
Well, Jack, and the other thing, by the way, is I'm remembering something that a listener actually said on our main program, On Point, and it was we were doing a show about inflation, and she said, I don't really care what the economists say or what the president says. If inflation is 8% or 7% or whatever, it still means that prices are not going down. They are still significantly higher than they were a couple of years ago. And, you know, that growth rate is still bigger than it was in the halcyon, I roll my eyes a little bit, 2% days. So, I mean, I think that, again, is the day-to-day reality of Americans' lives that you're pointing to that's just not captured in the indices that government uses. Are any members of Biden's inner circle, if I can put it that way, sort of rethinking how they did or are talking about inflation?
Well, one who is the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen. And in a recent interview, she had this to say.
I have every expectation that the single largest contributor to it, to inflation, is going to be moving down over this year.
And that will bring the rest of it with it. So in 2021, you did say that inflation was transitory. Do you regret saying that now?
I regret saying it was transitory. It has come down, but I think transitory means a few weeks or months to most people.
What do you think, Jack?
Intellectual honesty is what I think. I mean, that's quite, you know, good for her. But transitory lingers in the air. And as you just pointed out, even though the rate of increase is sharply down on inflation, the plateau where prices went, that hasn't fallen much. So it's not like she can pat herself on the back. You know, it transitory, yeah, it was an inept usage, but it's nice to see intellectual honesty.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're shining a light on something which is long been a bugbear of mine, Jack, and that is really important measures that we have to have some way of measuring, right? The well-being of America and Americans, but some of the most important ones, like you're talking about here, are actually, I don't know, purposefully disconnected from the lives of 21st century Americans. And that just reminded me of the last thought of Robert Kennedy's famous gross national product speech that he gave at the University of Kansas in 1968, where he basically said, you know, the gross national product does not measure the true things of value in American life. The health of children, he said, for example. Mm-hmm. He ends that passage by saying, it measures everything, in short, that which makes life worthwhile. So just a thought to leave people with there. So, I mean, obviously, I think the question for Jack Potters today is clear. Do you think that the government's measure of inflation captures everything in the life that you're living that is impacted by inflation? And I guess we're also curious, Jack, about, you know, how have people been experiencing this high inflation over the past several years? So go to your phone, smartphone, and look up On Point Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps, if you haven't done it already. And let us know, like, what do you think about the fact that so many economic measures, including the ones we discussed here today, don't necessarily capture the totality of your economic and financial lives? Yeah, I think that we'll get quite a few responses, Jack, on that one. And I'm hoping that some of them are actually along the lines of this Jack Potter, who sent us a message last week.
This is Lon Hughes from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Love you, Jack. And Meghna.
Jack, I'm proud. I'm proud to be Lon's afterthought, because an afterthought is still being thought of. So.
He's my third cousin once removed. So, you know.
All right. Well, we'll hear more from Jack's distant relations, whose checks have cleared, apparently, when we come back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
Well, Jack, we are back, and now it's time, as we always do, to hear from your listeners. Last week, we talked about the leopard, and remind me very quickly, it was the leopard in the temple and how that becomes normalized, right, Jack?
Yes, it's a Kafka parable about how leopards steal into the temple and drink the wine and the chalices, and this happens again and again, and pretty soon people expect the leopard. And that becomes part of the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And it's a parable, of course, about how we accept the unacceptable and sort of normalize it. And Donald Trump is exhibit A, B, C, and the rest of the alphabet on that proposition.
That's right. So the normalization of crazy, essentially, in our politics, if I
yes.
can put it that
yes.
way. So
yes.
here is Scott, who sent us a message from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I was not familiar with Kafka's leopard analogy. I was more familiar with an analogy created by a Twitter user named Cavalorn in the ancient year 2015, when they tweeted, and I quote, "I never thought leopards would eat my face," sobs woman who voted for the leopards eating people's faces party.
Okay, well, Scott.
Thank goodness for humor, even in the darkest times. Here's another
gosh.
Jack Potter. This is Bert Kushnet from Madison, Wisconsin.
The best way to know what Trump will do is to just listen to what he says on the campaign trail. Recently, he predicted a bloodbath if he lost the election. Well, in 2020, he did lose the election. And he gave us just that, the January 6th bloodbath. Ignoring his threat is at our own peril.
What do you think, Jack?
I think Bert is absolutely right. Ignoring the threat is, it's almost a civic duty to face up to it. And the question of violence, if I may, someone at the Bulwark did a very useful piece of work. You know, Trump he begins his rallies now with the January 6th choir singing the Star Spangled Banner. And he's called these people patriots, and he says he's going to pardon them and so on. And this fellow in the Bulwark went back and looked at the indictments, looked at the things these people were convicted of. Let me just give you a quick sketch of this. There's a Jeffrey Sabat in California. He used a helmet, a trauma kit, and a buck knife and zip ties. He entered with those. He knocked an officer down a flight of steps into the mob where he was beaten with a flagpole. Michael and Clifford Marquette, father and son hooligans, they assailed multiple officers, striking and pushing. The son grabbed a face mask off one officer so fiercely that the officer screamed in agony. Then we have another fellow, 32 years old, from Michigan. He used a hockey stick to attack the police. He quote them, this is from the indictment, struck at them at least 11 times, swinging away at their faces and necks, quote, as if he were chopping wood with an axe. He got 48 months. On and on. These are the people Donald Trump calls patriots, who beat policemen with hockey sticks and gouged them with flags and flagpoles. It is a of all the disgraceful things Trump has done, this may be the worst. And of course, this from the president who says he stands for law and order.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a saying that has become a little familiar over the past, decade or so, that when someone shows you who he is, believe them, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
There is another perfect and grim example. Okay, we've got one more. This is John Fitzgerald from Camden, Massachusetts, and he has a specific theory about Donald Trump's fire hose of lies.
Donald Trump's propensity to alter the truth, just to lie outright, I guess, is something that is a reflection of his vulnerability. And the more he does it, perhaps means the more vulnerable he feels or insecure. And so he has to do it. And not only that, but the people who are listening to it, whether they believe it or not, is not important, really. They applaud him. They cheer for him. They love him when he tells them these things. You know, that's a feedback loop. He's just getting what he needs all the time.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I'm not a psychiatrist, but over the Trump years, George Conway, the lawyer, constitutional lawyer, would publish regularly what the psychiatric DSM?
Is that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Right.
Yep.
How it defines malignant narcissism, your 9 criteria, and Trump met every one. And the root of it is this hollowness at the center of the self. People feel empty and therefore completely vulnerable to almost any criticism the world throws at them. So they sort of invent another world. And if they can get other people to go along with them, as John just pointed out, they're getting reinforced in their narcissism. They never have to have that moment of, I think they call it narcissistic shock, where suddenly they say, oh my God, the world isn't what I thought it was. I'm just as empty now as I can be, and no one is filling me up. Trump is getting filled up all the time, but the hole in the self is just there as absorbing everything. Maggie Haberman, who's watched him as closely as anyone, the New York Times reporter over the years, says he has to lie almost minute to minute because the anxiety about, you know, maybe things aren't quite the way I'm saying, steals in, and the lie covers it over. It's as much about his dealing with the hole inside as it is with his trying to, manipulate a group of people.
Well, with that, Jack, I'm thinking of Joe in Los Angeles, who admires me for my indefatigable American optimism. It's still there, but I will allow us to come to a close today on this more somber and thoughtful note that you've given us, Jack, okay?
Amen.
Well, Jack, again, thank you for the jackpot, as always.
My pleasure.
I am Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.